Trust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. It's produced by Pete Zimmerman. It's not engineered by Pete Zimmerman, though. Hi, it's it's John Williams, and we're here until 1 o'clock. We're glad you are, too. Lots of ground to cover today. You know, this headline is very interesting, isn't it? That despite, and Steve Alexander just mentioned this, too, despite the violence at the Capitol yesterday, the markets, which almost by definition are mercenary, are looking past that and are doing very, very well today. Let's start with Jason Turner then. On the Wintrust Business Lunch, Jason is the head of multi-asset strategies for Wintrust Wealth Management. Visit WintrustWealth.com. Hi, Jason. Welcome back.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me back.
Well, just put a spin on that, because the markets aren't impervious to the news. A lot of times something happens in the news and then you see a sway, even though the item they're reacting to wasn't financial per se. So why did the markets not have some sort of downtick today?
That's right. In their history, the markets have been sensitive to the news flow, and it's something I've been warning in my weekly writings to clients over the last month or so, really last quarter or so, as we ran up to the election even, that markets could see some short-term volatility just based on the news flow, things that happen in the news ticker. I think what the markets did yesterday is reacted very early in the morning to news of the results of the Georgia runoff elections, giving some certainty to the legislative direction and more directly, the chance for additional stimulus, and then saw the reaction. The markets did pull back a little bit yesterday afternoon as we saw some of this chaos emerge in our nation's capital, but they stabilized fairly quickly, and that sends a signal that the markets have sent a couple times over the last 2 months since Election Day that short-term news, be it COVID-related or post-election strife-related, is not going to deter the markets from their mid- to long-term focus on an eventual economic recovery.
Do you think what the markets did yesterday was less about what was happening at the Capitol and more about what happened in Georgia?
I think it's definitely more about what happened in Georgia. You saw that in the run-up in the morning in the index. And it's not just the broad index running up. It's where the gains happen. The gains happen in small-cap stocks. They happen in financial stocks, areas of the market that typically rally when we see the potential for growth and recovery.
What does this mean for unemployment then?
Well, unemployment still presents, I think, the largest headwind to economic growth over the long term. And we saw that in the numbers released this morning, weekly claims still nearly 800,000. For comparison, a year ago, the trailing four-week average was about 200,000 new claims for unemployment. So we're still four times what one would consider average in unemployment claims. That does act as a significant headwind to the economy. That's not likely to resolve until we start to see some improvement in the landscape of vaccine distribution, and that's likely not to occur until late February or early March.
Well, that's not late July or early December. I mean, if the markets are betting on the economy, then you wonder what the bet is. Where's that line where the economy is going to get better and the jobs will get better?
I think we'll see some economic pain in the short term. We're going to see the fourth quarter come in with still robust GDP growth once announced. We're going to see that pull back a little bit here in the first quarter as we continue to feel some of the impacts from pandemic-related restrictions and this unemployment headwind. But as we move through the year, we'll see stronger growth emerge in the latter half of the year, and we're likely to book the year on a GDP growth rate between 4.5% and 5% right now.
That's your estimate.
Yep.
Is that widely shared? Is that characterize that? Is that rosy? Is that pessimistic? Is that in the middle? Where is that?
Consensus right now is about 4.5% GDP growth for 2021. I think the odds of it going to the upside are a little higher than going to the downside. As we have seen the results of the Georgia elections emerge, there's a greater likelihood we'll see some short-term stimulus here towards the end of the first quarter to extend what was already passed at the tail end of 2020, and that's likely to be continually supportive of growth throughout the balance of 2021.
So the $2,000 stimulus check, do you think that's still going to happen then?
I think there'll be lots of conversations around the need for an additional stimulus check versus the need for continued unemployment benefit extension and potentially more direct support for small businesses. And I think the latter is probably the most impactful for broader economic growth in the U.S. We still have a very robust industry of small businesses across this country that have formed the fabric of our economic landscape for a long time, and they need support. And if they get that support, it's broadly supportive of economic growth for the U.S.
I'm glad you took our call today, Jason.
Well, good talking to you, John.
Jason Turner is the head of multi-asset strategies at Wintrust Wealth Management. Visit wintrustwealth.com. 1219, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN Radio. Ian Schur is the editor-at-large at CNET.com. Hi, Ian. Welcome back to the show.
How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. I have been checking Twitter and Facebook. I know that the president's accounts have been blocked on Facebook, and that on Twitter, while you can access his account, no new tweets are going up. They took down, didn't just flag, but took down his last two tweets, one of them the video that he actually shot after the rioting started yesterday at the Capitol. What's your read on this? What's happening? When are they going to restore his social media?
You know, that is the question of the day. Facebook has made it clear that at least in the next 2 weeks, Trump does not have access to his Facebook account, which, I mean, just to think that that Facebook has made the determination that the man who holds the nuclear codes is not safe to use Facebook is kind of a lot to get your head around. But the interesting thing to me personally is that we see these companies standing up in a way, honestly, that we haven't seen before. There's been a lot of pressure from people like me who and critics of Facebook and Twitter who say, look, not only is this stuff dangerous, and by stuff I mean a lot of these posts, not just the president, but a lot of the trolling that was considered trolling back then and a lot of the threats that are made online, they're not just people being people. They actually have dangerous consequences. And I think Facebook and Twitter, while they have good intentions, have always struggled to really take this stuff under heel. And now it seems as though at least they realize the gravity of the situation and that people like me weren't crazy people losing our heads about something, that like there's actually a danger here and are acting on it somehow. The question, of course, now is what do we do after this? Even if we go to January 21st, how does the world of social media change so that we don't have another attack on the Capitol that's organized on social media, or that we don't have another genocide in Myanmar that the United Nations investigation said was spurred on by social media and was a determining factor. So it's those types of things that I think we need to wrestle with coming forward.
Do you think then it was too little too late to finally silence the president on those platforms?
You know, look, I think whether or not to silence the president too late, I think some of that falls into like people's political views. I certainly believe that when you are egging on protesters that are violent and encouraging them, then there's a line that has been crossed. And it's not the first time that that line was crossed. So, you know, that's my personal point of view. But I think what's challenging is that this is all of our points of view, right? And at the end of the day, the people who actually points of view matter are Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey, the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter. They make the call, and they don't like being the arbiters of truth. And they try to say, yeah, you know, we want to be a marketplace of ideas, and all of that is becoming a problem now.
Well, this is only a comment about how complicated that is, because I didn't see a great distinction between his last two tweets, which I did see, and the ones before it. And even though they were flagged, the tweets before it, to me, were not markedly different from the two that they said are unacceptable. It makes you wonder if they knew then what they know now, how many of them would they have allowed all along?
You know, there is a great quote that comes from Reddit, actually. Reddit being one of those other social media sites that's often called the front page of the internet. It's very, very popular with a group of people. And one of the things that the CEO of Reddit said when the company started actually moderating its platform, it used to be completely pretty much do whatever you want. And there was a lot of nasty stuff on there, really bad stuff. And so he started moderating it and actually controlling it, shutting down some of the worst communities. I'm literally talking about neo-Nazi stuff. And one of the things he said when he was talking about why he chose to do this is that he said, I realized at one point that I was more focused on being technically correct about free speech than being morally right. And I think that is the realization that Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey are coming to as well.
What's your expectation for the incoming administration? Will they use Twitter as much as the previous one? I guess that's impossible, but I wonder if they will make it more just pro forma stuff and leave all of the rhetoric for TV interviews and stump speeches.
If I could bet on that, I think it's the easiest bet in the world that we're not going to see Biden tweeting like Trump. But I do think that the one thing Trump has taught us in the world of politics, if you take out the toxic stuff, is that the communication directly with the people is important, and that they respond to that. And some people really like it, and it, positive or negative, right? And so I think that you see actually Biden's voice in those tweets sometimes. Maybe there is pro forma stuff, but I think that there is value in them being able to speak out to us in a way that really wasn't able to be done before. You know, you had radio addresses on Saturdays, and you had an interview from the Oval Office or an Oval Office speech, but that was pretty much it other than rallies. So now having that opportunity, I think some senators and congressmen have shown a really great way to do it. So I can see value. It's just the question is whether or not they'll want to do it that way, too.
Very powerful tools, that's for sure. While the president doesn't seem to be able to get to people via them today, obviously he could go on Fox News and do a sit-down interview. I wonder if he'll be on Hannity tonight or something like that. But otherwise, he has been absent from the dialogue since what happened yesterday and since his stuff was taken down. Let's talk about movies now. Wonder Woman, you told us, was maybe not just going to save the galaxy, but maybe the box office. What happened to Wonder Woman 1984 now?
Yeah, so, you know, she did save the day a little bit. you know, what's I think interesting about Wonder Woman is that the first week of the box office was amazing. It did more than double the expectations. And even if that was a fraction of what a normal movie is, it was still really good. Second week, nosedive, right? Like completely just belly flopped. And I think part of what we're realizing here is that, you know, first off, it's on HBO Max, which if you don't know, we have a whole thing on CNET explaining how to sign up. A lot of people can get it for free. So that is one thing. The people who want to see it, like me, and don't want to go to a theater, we already did it. The people who do want to go to a theater, one of the things we heard from Warner Brothers is that a lot of people actually rented out the theaters for their friends, right? You can pay like $99 or something. It depends on the theater.
We have that
and
here.
You can rent out the whole thing for your bubble, right? That's super cool. Those people probably already did that too. So who's left? Right? There aren't a lot of second viewers or stuff like that, third time viewers. So I think that's part of like the reality of what we're living in right now is that people will rent out the theater and go see it with their bubble, and then that's it. And that's very different from what life used to be before the pandemic.
Yeah, no kidding. HBO Max got some pretty good stuff on there. Watched The Flight Attendant the other day. And by that, I mean I watched, I think it's a seven-part series the other day. We watched it in like a night, I think we got through that thing.
Really, yeah, Murder Whodunit. I haven't watched it yet, but I've heard interesting things.
It's dark, and it's funny, and it's a head-scratcher. It sure worked for me. I'm recommending it to all my patients who chew gum. Let's also talk, speaking of the movies, The Mandalorian is the most pirated TV show of 2020. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's this really interesting website called Torrent Freak, which is kind of like the news place of all of the stealing of movies and music in the world.
Yeah,
and they every year they come out with this list of the most pirated stuff on the internet. So The Mandalorian, which is from Disney Plus, it was the most pirated show of 2020, and it's interesting because this shows how impactful that show was. There was a lot of really high-profile television last year, and we're talking about, like, even the Tiger King, if you remember, it feels like a decade ago, but there was that. There was all sorts of stuff that became huge conversations online, but The Mandalorian was the biggest pirated show. And, by the way, before that, it was Game of Thrones for 7 years running. So I think what it tells us, A, is that Disney has really hit lightning in a bottle here, And it shows. I mean, they've got 86 million subscribers, more than that, I think. And that's only within a year. So they're already doing super well. Of course, the problem is, of course, this is pirated stuff and it's illegal and it means that Disney doesn't get any money. And that sucks. But it's also, in a very weird way, a positive indication for them of how well this is doing.
People are getting stimulus checks and they might get another one. You all posted an article about how you can have that deposited into your Venmo account, right?
Yes. That is a super cool thing. So, you know, one of the things that if you're getting a check and you're not getting a actual deposit into your bank, and by the way, we have, there's a tool from the IRS at irs.gov. Of course, we at CNET have a link to it that will actually tell you where you are in that system, because they're sending out the payments in batches, whether you're going to get it through your direct deposit or through a check or through a debit card. So if you get a check, and you can't change that now, by the way, you're going to get one of those even if you don't want it. So if you're going to get a check, you can actually use Venmo, which is an online, you know, it's an app on your phone that's owned by PayPal, to actually take a photo of the check and then deposit it into your account. Now, a lot of people like me would say, well, what's the point of that? Well, first off, they're waiving all the fees. So that's a key thing to remember. And the second thing to remember is that there are a lot of people in this country, not as many as overseas, of course, but there are a lot of people in this country who don't have access to bank accounts. And Venmo and the tech industry broadly are trying to help those people. So suddenly you think, well, 5% fee, that's now zero. Think about all those cash check cashing people who are on the corner who charge a lot more.
They are
now being challenged from the tech industry.
I got a text message from a friend this morning who said, when I popped on Netflix last night after things in D.C. calmed down, the banner show being promoted on Netflix was Designated Survivor. Was that random or was that intentional?
1,000% random. And what I think is really interesting about Netflix, you know, okay, I should say 999% random, because, you know, there is a possibility someone decided. But generally speaking, one of the things that I think is amazing about Netflix is that they use those computer programs that learn what you like. They are super aggressive about learning from that data and showing you stuff. Down to the point, I don't know if anyone's noticed this, the posters you see on the films or the TV shows actually change depending on who you are. I got a different poster. You can see, like, for Coco, right, the Disney film, I would see a picture of the kid playing the drum. But if my son signed on to Netflix under his account, he would actually see one of the skeletons dancing. And it's because of what Netflix thinks we would like more. So it's those types of things that when you see a coincidence, like Designated Survivor, which frankly, if someone did that, it's a terrible joke, right? Which is why I think it's an algorithm.
Yeah.
You know, it means that person likes thrillers and they like political stuff and they probably watch The West Wing. And at one point, Netflix probably saw Designated Survivor also getting popular all of a sudden. And they're like, oh, everyone who loves The West Wing probably loves this, and started putting it in your feed.
Ian Schur is the editor at large at CNET.com. Talk to you again next week. Thank you, Ian.
Absolutely. Take care.
It is 12:35. You are listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening with your bank account, your credit cards, and interest rates. Joining us on the phone line is Greg McBride, Senior Vice President and Chief Analyst at Bankrate.com. Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, John. Happy New Year.
Yeah, likewise. And rates are still at historically attractive levels, right?
In most cases, yes. And I think this is going to be a year where you're going to continue to see very favorable financing terms. Rates very competitive on things like car loans could trickle even lower. You could see some greater credit availability in the back half of the year, provided that we do get a more robust economic recovery once vaccinations reach mass scale. Mortgage rates, I think, are going to be quite a bit more volatile because they're based on long-term rates. Those long-term rates move based on the outlook for the economy and inflation. So, you know, I do think what we've seen the past couple of days with those rates moving up is a glimpse of what we'll likely see in the back half of the year. In the meantime, you know, we still have a lot of economic weakness to work our way through. So, you don't have to worry about mortgage rates running away from you this year by any means.
Can you walk me through that? How is it that banks then make money if for 30 years they lend me money at such an extraordinarily low rate, especially since rates might go higher in the long term, but I've locked in this fixed rate mortgage?
Yeah, and that's why there's a secondary market that really plays such a huge role on mortgages. A lot of lenders don't hold that loan. They get paid for making a loan, and then they turn around and they sell it to an entity like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or investors that buy up mortgage bonds in bulk. And then it functions like a mortgage-backed security that then functions much like any other bond. And so the demand among those investors is really what drives the bus in terms of the rates that are being available, that are made available and being quoted to borrowers at any given point in time. A lot of banks, the margins are really, really narrow because those long-term rates are so low. And, you know, that's also why you see deposit rates, you know, scraping along the zero bound, 0% bound, because as interest rates come down, deposit rates can only go so low, but, you know, oftentimes the loan rates tend to fall faster and it squeezes bank margins.
Yeah, I wonder what we should tell consumers then, that that's a fair trade. If you had to pick one, you would do that. Inexpensive to borrow, but you just don't have a safe place to put it and get a guaranteed return.
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately,
well, that was a question, by the way. That is
it is good. You know, an environment that, you know, the playbook that gets rolled out every time the economy rolls over is to cut interest rates, to disincentivize saving and encourage borrowing and investing. That's the monetary policy recipe for reflating an economy, and that's the playbook that's currently open right now, given what we've seen economically from the pandemic last year. And that's going to persist this year. I mean, the Fed has said they're going to stay on the sidelines, and not just this year, but likely for the next couple of years. That's going to keep those short-term rates really low. Good news for somebody looking to buy a car. Good news for consumers that have good credit and are taking out a credit card, a home equity loan, personal loan, those kind of things. But not good news for retirees or savers that are trying to garner some interest income on the money that they've tucked away.
If you were thinking about buying a house then in the next 3 years, 5 years, like you're just thinking, okay, I don't know that I have enough money now. Maybe I will in 4 years. Maybe better to bite the bullet now, huh?
Well, it's really hard to forecast not only what happens in real estate, but what happens in life over the course of multiple years. But, I mean, in terms of this year, if you're entering a life stage where you're considering a home purchase, your biggest obstacle is going to be, can you find one that's available for sale? It's not going to be,
that's true,
gee, where are mortgage rates? Rates are they're not going to be the impediment. They're going to be the tailwind that you have this year, even if they do move up, as I expect they will as the economy recovers. I've got the mortgage rates ending the year higher than where they started, but still, it's just a bit over 3%. So, you know, bottom line is this is still going to be a really good year for financing from the home purchase standpoint. Problem again, like I said, just, you know, if you can't buy it if it's not for sale. And right now there's not a whole lot of homes out there for sale relative to demand.
And the people that are selling know that. So you almost feel like a fool if you're running out and buying something now, attractive as the rates are, because you know you're paying more than you might have a year and a half ago or might a year and a half from now.
Yeah, well, there's no certainty about that year and a half from now, though, right? And I think that's what causes a lot of these, you know, bidding wars and, a lot of the surge in home prices that many markets have seen is the fact that, you know, people are kind of, you know, rushing to jump on, before things, you know, move away from them from an affordability standpoint.
Can you talk about then car rates? You mentioned those, that they are a little more volatile than, say, the home loan rates, but what numbers are people getting for car loans right now?
Less volatile than home loan rates. I think, you know, the car loan rates are, they're already at very low levels. I see a lot of sub 4%, even some sub 3% rates on both new and used cars. And that's a level that's going to persist this year. And in fact, I think you'll see perhaps even greater competition among lenders that can bring about even lower rates as the year progresses. Again, for those that have good credit, for those with weaker credit, I think the good news is that credit will loosen up later in the year as the economy recovers. And so, you know, the person who couldn't get approved now or can't get approved on favorable terms now, you know, just could find a more favorable environment later in the year. But, you know, a lot of what we were talking about in housing, some of that's evident in the auto space, too, where, you know, the pinch on production last year means that a lot of dealer inventory is limited relative to what it normally is. And that has driven up prices. So the financing isn't the problem. The price people are paying for cars is the problem. Mm. And so, you know, for a lot of people, you know, the biggest threat to their household budget is what's parked in the driveway. When car payments are $550, $600 a month or more, you know, that causes a lot of strain. So, again, the financing is very attractive this year, but, you know, it's the price people are paying that I think has its limits.
Let's talk next time, too, about credit cards. We got to go now, but credit card rates are 16-17% around there, right?
16, yes. And if you have good credit, you can get better rates. If you've got weaker credit, it's still tough sledding out there.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today, Greg.
Appreciate it, John. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Greg McBride, Senior Vice President, Chief Analyst at Bankrate.com. Let's go into the WGN Radio Newsroom. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The inventory of homes for sale in the Chicago area has dipped to the lowest level on record. Midwest Real Estate Data compiled the numbers for Cranes. At the end of December, there were enough homes on the market for 1.8 months of sales. Usually an inventory of 4 to 6 months is considered a healthy level. It's not limited to Chicago. It's happening nationally, too. Walgreens released a quarterly earnings report showing it beat estimates by 19 cents a share, with earnings of $1.22 per share. Revenue also exceeded Wall Street expectations. Walgreens says the business environment remains challenging, but it's maintaining its prior fiscal 2021 forecast. Oreo cookie maker Mondelez International is releasing yet another new flavor. Strawberry Frosted Donut Oreos will be made with vanilla cookies and feature a double layer of pink-colored strawberry-flavored cream with rainbow sprinkles and a donut-flavored cream, available in March. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
So just to make sure, I'm Googling Oreo cookies, and it's a chocolate wafer on the outside.
I beg to differ. I'm looking at the Oreo, the Mondelez release shows a vanilla wafer
right
on the outside.
Yeah.
So it's a light-colored wafer.
Amy Guth, are you listening to this?
I am hearing this. This is an epic moment in radio history right now. We're hearing this Oreo fight breaking out. Yeah. I like this.
I do not. All right. So I'm going to leave the Oreo talk with Steve Alexander for tomorrow's show. We'll devote probably 3 hours to that. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Mondelez has really been evolving what they're doing with Oreos. They've made some light-colored ones to go with this kind of lemon cream flavor. They've done some vanilla. They've done pumpkin spice. They've done a lot of things. So this might be a agree to disagree about the value of Oreo right now.
Yeah, well, it's not just the value, but it's the actual appearance of it. So I got to get my eyeballs on the actual cookie itself. Meanwhile, let's talk about Walgreens, which has topped its fiscal first quarter forecast as it's fighting the pandemic. What's the story with Walgreens? How good are they in the first quarter?
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch Walgreens, of course, based in Deerfield. So that's a one here in our backyard that we watch closely. Interesting things, because there's a lot of nuances in their Q1 fiscal reporting and, you know, where they struggled with stores being closed, particularly in the UK. They've been struggling with the UK stores for quite a while. But what the pandemic caused to you know, be lost revenue and store closings and lowered foot traffic of people not going out as much, they did kind of make up for a bit, or they're starting to anyway, with, as we're seeing, vaccine rollout. So that's why Walgreens and CVS both have had kind of a mixed kind of bumpy ride when we look at their stock over time, because we're seeing, you know, close downs and stay home orders have made for lower foot traffic. in a moment when they've kind of been struggling with their identity, both as a retailer and a pharmacy. But then the announcement of Walgreens and CVS taking the wheel for vaccine distribution certainly boosted what was going on there. It's going to be interesting to kind of watch that full recovery. One part of the business, they said, was an issue was the Amerisource Bergen area. That's kind of their stake in a drug wholesaler. And they're ridding themselves of that and kind of moving away from that. So it's like a lot of nuance to it, but still kind of came out higher than expectations. And so shares did climb once markets opened. Of course, they released that after trading the other day.
I know that Walgreens type stores don't sell tobacco anymore, right? You can't buy cigarettes at a Walgreens. I don't think so. I'm just wondering if in the near future, since there's medicinal value to marijuana, if CBD and marijuana products will be sold at a Osco or a Costco, you know, a Rite Aid, Walgreens, something like that.
Yeah, it will be interesting. I think a lot of people are looking at that, and we've seen some reaction today and yesterday, too, from marijuana stocks, because once we saw what the results of the runoff were going to be in Georgia, that kind of opens the idea of decriminalizing marijuana on a federal level. So there's two bills, I think, that will be important to watch. One, of course, backed by Kamala Harris. It is the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, called the MORE Act, that would decriminalize marijuana on a federal level. The other one that I think is probably more likely, because that's a really big step. This one is a little more kind of a baby step, and that's called the STATES Act. That's strengthening the 10th Amendment through entrusting states. And that would allow cannabis companies to have access to things like banking, financial services, and how they approach taxes and things like that. Because right now, a lot of investors and banks don't want to necessarily touch these very lucrative marijuana startups because of that federal issue. So to decriminalize or to move towards it on a federal level, even just for banking, I think would really change that. So we have really seen an uptick in marijuana stocks this week. Canopy was one of those that we, you know, really just saw kind of a quick reaction from the markets in that one.
Speaking of marijuana, do we know what the value of Neil Young's rights are to his catalog?
That was a really good segue.
Thank
good
you.
Job.
Yes.
You know, the full value is unclear, but he has sold half of his song catalog to a fund in the UK called Hypnosis. It's not the usual spelling of hypnosis. It's got a G in there somewhere. But they have taken, so that's about copyright interest for about 1,180 songs. The value of that has been reported to be about $150 million. So if that is accurate, we could say $300 million would be a reasonable ballpark there for that number. And this Hypnosis Song Fund, they've been kind of on a tear. On Tuesday, they announced that they had acquired the entire catalog of Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac. They've also got some, they bought some interest in rights to some Barry Manilow songs and some Blondie songs. So they're, you know, this is a company that they're really snapping up a lot of pretty valuable stuff when we're talking about, you know, song catalogs.
Oh, yeah, that's, right.
That's pretty valuable, yeah.
Incidentally, pardon me, go ahead and finish that thought, Amy.
No, I was just going to say, you know, one part of that is Neil Young has really always really pushed back on the idea of his songs being used for commercial use. And so the, you know, leadership from this firm said that they're not going to, you know, they're not going to start licensing his songs in a way that would make him uncomfortable. It's going to be a way that he still feels comfortable with. But we might see more access to his songs, a little bit more open access.
Well, a couple of listeners texted in and just reminded me that you can buy cigarettes at Walgreens. CVS does not. So thanks for the heads up on that and straightening us out. You can buy tobacco at Walgreens. CVS does not. Well, heck, if you can do that, then you watch down the road.
Right.
You're going to see marijuana and I don't know if they have CBD products, but it would seem to me like if you can do one, you might end up doing the other. We got one minute left. Okay. I wanted to ask you real quick about the value of Elon Musk's assets. He's now, we heard a moment ago, the richest person in the world. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So in he passed Warren Buffett in July. He passed Bill Gates in November. He's kind of in neck and neck with Jeff Bezos. And if you're, it's kind of what list you're looking at. Forbes has a list that's kind of real time that has reported that he has surpassed Bezos by about $3 billion because it includes the value of Elon Musk's options, which he gets as part of his pay package. That's about 33 million shares of Tesla. That is a very, very valuable asset to have right there. So they put Jeff Bezos' net worth at $186 billion, and Musk, without that, is $172 billion. But adding this 33 million shares of Tesla certainly boosts his net worth. And so Forbes has declared that he is the richest person in the world with a net worth of about $184 billion.
Okay,
which is
so
kind of unfathomable.
Yeah, I know that. That means absolutely nothing to me.
Yeah,
I'm familiar with smaller numbers. It's nice to hear you. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.